Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Kevin Pina, and we're going to be talking about the island country of Haiti. Kevin is from the San Francisco Bay Area, but he's been living in Haiti nonstop for the last 2 years, and has been there many times before. Kevin Pina is an independent filmmaker. He's made a documentary on Haiti. And also, he teaches editing to people who work in the TV stations in Haiti. And you report for KPFA here in the Bay Area, and you know a lot about what's going on in Haiti, and that's what we want to let people know about. You and I were just speaking, Kevin, about putting Haiti in a global context, because it is just a small island country in the Caribbean, and although it's also the 200th anniversary of Haiti's independence, so-called independence. We'll be talking more about that. And it was the first black revolution and the black republic in the Western Hemisphere, and that has been a struggle since the beginning and continuing up till now. So how are things in Haiti these days, and what would you like to start out with? And we'll talk about President Aristide. You may know that name.
Things in Haiti today are difficult, as they have been for a long time. Probably what's most difficult is that you have a small opposition called the Democratic Convergence, who are backed by Washington and who were actually helped and created by IRI, the International Republican Institute, which is sort of the international wing of the Republican Party, in the name of creating democratic pluralism, what they call pluralism or multi-party democracy in Haiti. Unfortunately, this small opposition doesn't represent many people in Haiti and doesn't have a widespread base. But yet, it's managed through the Organization of American States and with the backing of several powerful Republicans in Washington to pretty much isolate and freeze Haiti out of dialogue for its own future with the international community, meaning that, for example, Haiti is supposed to have elections, which are supposed to happen before the beginning of next year. If those elections don't happen, then Haiti will have no parliament. If Haiti doesn't have a parliament, then President Aristide has to rule by decree. If President Aristide rules by decree, then a lot of them are going to say, ha-ha, we told you so, this man is a dictator. So obviously, the Haitian government is now considering going ahead with elections, despite the fact that the small opposition I described earlier, backed by Washington and IRI, the International Republican Institute, refused to participate in elections. They refused to name members to the Election Commission, which is responsible for overseeing the elections. In addition, they have allies in what are called civil society organizations.
You know, I'm going to interrupt you, and it's my own fault, but we just back it up a little teeny bit to talk about how President Aristide was elected in 1990. He was a Catholic priest and at some point left the priesthood. But anyway, he was very, very democratically elected, as I understand, in 1990, and then taken out of power right by the United States.
He was elected in December of 1990 with the highest plurality of any presidential candidate in the history of the hemisphere, 67% of the vote. He then ran again in 2000, 10 years later, because the Haitian Constitution says that a president cannot secede themselves, so he had to sit one term out. And then he ran again in 2000 and won again by an overwhelming majority, although again this small clique called the opposition in Haiti boycotted the elections. Those presidential elections in 2000 were preceded by 2 weeks of hell, drive-by shootings, pipe bombings that claimed the lives of six people and wounded 14 others in those 2 weeks preceding the presidential elections in 2000. Yes, he's a former priest of the liberation theology brand, meaning that He comes out of the progressive wing of the Catholic Church that are consider themselves liberation theologists, which came out of Vatican II, which basically gave preferential treatment to the poor. I guess the fundamental belief is that whereas a wealthy man is concerned with going to heaven, a poor man is concerned with eating, and that you can't expect a man to find God if he doesn't have enough sustenance to have a creative and healthy life. And I guess the other part of that is that to walk in the footsteps of Jesus means to walk in the footsteps of the poor. So Father Aristide was an adherent of that movement. And one of the main, I think, breaks with the traditional Catholic Church in Haiti as well as outside of Haiti is that the ultimate conclusion of that philosophy is that if it means to get involved in politics, to change the political structures in order to better people's lives, then so be it. And that's where Aristide entered the arena and threw his hat into the arena in Haiti.
Yeah, and when it comes to poor, I think Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. I've been there myself for just a short time, and I've been all over the world, and it's certainly I haven't, including in India. Well, it's I don't know, it's different than India, but not that different. I mean, it is incredibly poor. People just living on top of garbage heaps, basically. I'm not too easily freaked out, and it wasn't that I was scared, but it was just so hard to see that kind of poverty, and I know it's going from bad to worse, as in most of the world, every day.
Well, Haiti is can be tough. I've actually lived in Haiti 3 years now, and I just spent the last 21 months in Haiti solid without having left the country, and I can tell you that over time it takes its toll on you, particularly if you don't come from that culture and if you don't come from the poor. I mean, I can identify with them. I can act in solidarity with them. I can understand the history of the struggle of the poor in Haiti, but I'm not poor. And so if you live under those conditions and you're not used to it, it can take its toll. But there's also another side to this, which is that although they may be poor financially, they may be poor materially, I think that the Haitian people can be said to be very wealthy spiritually, can be very wealthy in terms of their ability to survive in that kind of environment and climate, and their ability to continue to create as artists and as musicians and
how much art
and as politicians in that kind of environment. I mean, that's probably one of the biggest challenges that Aristide's government and Aristide's party and government has ever had, which is that there has always been and continues to be this ongoing friction, conflict, violence, and at times nearing civil war between the majority of the population who are so desperately poor and a very, very tiny elite that controls through monopolies the majority of the wealth and that which is able to create and generate wealth in Haiti.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, back to that, the political struggle.
So just imagine for a second being in that position where you have the ruling party and you're the first democratically elected president, you know, in the history of the country in 186 years, referring to Aristide's first term, now being reelected and having to manage a situation where you're asking the poor to wait because they want it now. You understand? They want to break the system now. The poor, in a lot of ways, want revolution in Haiti. At the same time, if that were to happen, U.S. troops would land tomorrow. No one's silly here.
We know that because of the past.
Absolutely. You know, it wouldn't be the first time, whether it be in Haiti alone, but also in the history of Latin America and the Caribbean. So put yourself in that situation. There's a lot of zigging and zagging, I think, that has to go on in order to maintain enough stability so that the base of democracy, which are the community organizations, women's organizations, rights organizations, but mostly community-based organizations trying to improve conditions in those poor conditions that we described earlier, in their own communities. Mm-hmm. I think what Aristide is trying to do is to create enough of a space and compromise to allow that nascent movement of the grassroots poor to actually put down real roots politically and to develop its own political culture so that for the first time it can actually realize full participation in the affairs of Haiti. And of course, this is something that the elite have never tolerated and have never wanted, because after all, they've always considered themselves to be the ones who have the greatest education. They always consider themselves to be the ones who should determine what should be the future of Haiti. And by virtue of that, control Haitian politics exclusively.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you could talk, Kevin Pina, about the connections with globalization, with the greater ruling class of the world.
Well, I mean, I've thought about this a lot recently, and I realize that I think that everyone, all of us, as a world community, are fighting the same thing, or confronting the same, for want of a better word, adversary. I was going to say enemy, but I think maybe that's too strong. Let's be respectful and say adversary. And it really is, for me, a question of sovereignty. Whether that be the sovereignty of the individual to determine their own future and rights, to have control over their own body, as in the case of women, the choice of women, and the choice of men, but particularly you can understand why I bring that up, or whether that be the question of communities being able to say no to corporations. We don't want these particular poisons in our community. We don't want these particular multinational corporations able to poison our communities. Whether that be the issue of states, such as the state of California, or any state, we're in California now, but any state, or whether that be nations. I think on all of those levels, what we're fighting for is sovereignty, the right of people to determine, to determine their own futures, whether that be the individual or whether that be the nation state.
Self-determination is another way of saying it.
Absolutely. And it seems to me as if particularly the Bush administration in this particular period of history, that this is really where the struggle, what we're confronting, because it seems to me that it's the same 16 corporations, it's the same 18 corporations, that famous list, that actually control the politics of the United States, and our political choices are determined largely by a small group of multinational corporations that exert tremendous power, as we know, through lobbying and through cash buyouts and payments and investments, et cetera. And I think those are the same companies that are responsible for U.S. policy towards the WTO, or participation in the World Trade Organization, or participation in the Inter-American Development Bank. All of those institutions which represent U.S. foreign policy that are dictating to communities how they can defend themselves, what rights they have in the world, versus what rights those multinational corporations, with their increasing power and mergers, have over our lives. And so it's the same struggle that we as individuals are fighting, that we in our communities are fighting, that is the same struggle that the people of Haiti are fighting. And I don't see them as separate. I see them very much as tied together and interdependent.
Yeah, absolutely. When you just said the word environment, it just popped into my mind all the mountains that are just deforested between people needing firewood and corporations taking out wood. And, you know, it's the same. All the interviews I do, it's the same stories over and over and over again. And maybe, Kevin, however, we have time for you to share some specifics about things that are going on in Haiti in terms of particularly corporations or environmental issues.
Well, I mean, there's for example, it's very difficult, because the truth about Haiti also is that the current government is not very popular with the Bush administration. It seems to be that popular democracies in general are not very popular with the United States. Whether you go back to Jacobo Arbenz, who was overthrown by a CIA-engineered coup in 1953.
Guatemala.
Or Guatemala or Chile, and the example in 75 of Salvador Allende and Unidad Popular. We can see that U.S. foreign policy in Latin America and the Caribbean does not tolerate popular democracies. Why? Because the kind of democracy they want is a democracy without sovereignty. Back to the issue of sovereignty again. It's okay for you to use the window dressing of democracy, even if you're a dictator and a human rights abuser, as long as it serves U.S. foreign policy interests. Now, the obverse is true, too, which is that it's not okay to have a popular democracy where your elected officials are more beholden to their constituency than they are to U.S. foreign policy interests. And that's the situation that Haiti's confronting today. And it's made particularly almost absurdist by the fact that people like Otto Reich, the former head of the Office of Public Diplomacy under the Reagan administration, who was nearly indicted by Congress because he used U.S. taxpayer dollars in order to cover the cocaine-fueled war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. He actually created a propaganda organization within the State Department that did not answer to Congress, but was independent. This is now the man who is one of the men who is in charge of U.S. foreign policy towards Haiti. Roger Noriega of the OAS is a former
Organization of American States.
Right, is a former disciple of Jesse Helms. He learned his chops under Senator Jesse Helms, who's made no question about the fact that he hates Aristide and he hates this so-called ugly little experiment in democracy that's happening in Haiti. So at the same time, you've got the Dominican Republic, which is right next door on the same island, Hispaniola, where you have former members of the former military. Now remember that when Aristide first came to office in 1990, he was overthrown by a brutal military coup in 91 after only 7 months in office. Then he spent 3 years in exile, where there was...
And that military coup, of course, was supported with our tax dollars.
Well, certainly, a case can be made that the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush supported that coup. I believe a strong case could be made for that. However, after that coup, then Aristides returned at the head of 20,000 American troops with the stated intention of restoring democracy. Well, of course, what they meant by restoring democracy was trying to keep intact and rehabilitate the former military, who had broken up into small drug fiefdoms and were eating themselves alive. So it really wasn't this altruistic reason that they'd like to portray that the Clinton administration intervened in Haiti. Also, there was the pressure of refugees that were being forced to flee the country. God knows we've got enough black people in Miami already, right? We don't need more of them, so we better fix the Haiti situation.
And we know, I'll interrupt again, because we know that the treatment of Haitian refugees has been just heartbreaking and very in great contrast with those refugees from Cuba.
Particularly organizations that have tried, who opportunistically have tried to use that issue to bash the government in order to claim political asylum for their clients. It's been shameful, and I think it's only confused the issue, rank opportunism in the case of some so-called human rights organizations and human rights attorneys working on behalf of Haitians. Back to the stream of history, Aristide was returned in 1994, but of course, by that time, the majority of his term in office had expired in exile. The United States did not want him to resume the time that he had lost in exile, and so he was forced to accept an agreement of new elections, presidential elections, and leave office. But what he did before he left office was he abolished the Haitian military, and he officially recognized Cuba, the island of Cuba, which of course incensed U.S. foreign policymakers beyond belief. First of all, the Pentagon was upset because they, of course, had a huge, tremendous investment over the years in building the Haitian military, as they have with so many military institutions throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. Also, the recognition of Cuba on his way out the door was obviously thumbing his nose at the U.S. government and saying, hey, Haiti is a sovereign country, and our relationship with the region of the world will be determined by us, even though we know you're the big guy with the big stick. So, now if you fast forward to last May, the Dominican Republic was used as a staging ground by 20 former members of the former Haitian military to perform an armed incursion, an armed invasion into Haiti on the border. They kidnapped and tortured and killed two security guards, and they blew up the control station for the country's only hydroelectric producing generator. And that was staged from the Dominican Republic. It's also no secret that a year ago that the United States sent 20,000 new M16s to the Dominican military in order to expand their patrols of the Haitian border, while 800 U.S. military advisors have been rotating in and out over the last year. So one has to ask, if there's all these U.S. military advisors in the Dominican Republic now, if the Dominican Republic has received 20,000 new M16s to bolster their border patrol, then why is it that 20 commandos in camouflage, fully armed with heavy automatic weapons, were able to come into Haiti, perform this act of terror, and then return to the Dominican Republic, and no one was ever caught or captured, no one was ever stopped, the United States has never said one word about it, the Dominican government has never said one word denouncing it. One has to ask, where is this coming from, and what is the real intention of the United States government, and what is the real intention of the Dominican military, who we know are the ones who are arming and harboring these criminals in the Dominican Republic?
Well, it sounds like an old story. And again, I'm repeating about our tax money, because people in the United States who are hearing this should know that they're also in the loop, whether they want to be or not. And so much of the violence of the world is done with our tax money, in fact. So I guess taxpayers revolt, that would be good. Where are we right now? I mean, right now we are September, almost the famous September 11th in the year 2003. Although you were just recently in Haiti, you've just come back to the United States. And what's it like on a daily basis?
It's been tough. It's been made tougher by this unofficial economic embargo on behalf of that small group of the so-called opposition, the Democratic Convergence. Basically, what they've done is they've stopped all economic and financial assistance directly to the Haitian government. At the same time, the United States has given millions and millions of dollars to non-governmental organizations, NGOs. I mean, basically what that's done is that it's strapped the Haitian government to perform the services that are necessary in order to put into plans, implement fully the plans that the government has had for raising the standard of living of the Haitian people. At the same time, it's put that money in the hands of non-governmental organizations who are openly antagonistic to the government, who will only work with people who are antagonistic to the government. It's made life worse for the average Haitian. Now, we recently had the IADB, the Inter-American Development Bank, say that they were going to release $145 million in loans that were slated for infrastructure, hospitals, schools, basic things that any society needs in order to improve the lot of its people. However, not one nickel of that money has actually been received yet by the Haitian government, although lots of people are patting themselves on the back. We're still waiting to see if the IADB is going to come through with its promise to unfreeze that. But the point is that I've never believed that a poor people could be made even poorer, mm-hmm. that a people who were suffering so much could be forced to suffer even greater desperate circumstances, as I've seen over the last 2 years with this unofficial economic embargo on behalf of this tiny opposition. That's what makes it so galling, is that the opposition in Haiti that the U.S. says it's claiming to protect their rights for is so small and has such small representation in Haiti that to hold up the majority who've chosen their government, as I said, it's an attack against the sovereignty of the Haitian people.
So what are we talking about, a few hundred, a few thousand people?
A few thousand people.
Uh-huh. And also, wasn't it so that because of the International Monetary Fund doing their usual thing about privatizing, that all the money that the Haitian government could get from the industries that they owned, they were all privatized, so the Haitian government basically has no way of getting income at all?
Well, the Haitian government actually fought against the privatization over the last 2 years. They have not sold off the National Telephone Company and said they've been seeking independent investors to come in with capital in order to upgrade the equipment in the system. The same thing with the National Electric Company. So the basic structures that were once owned by the government are still owned by the people of Haiti. However, the difficulty is in finding cash in order to upgrade and improve those delivery systems. Yeah. Particularly the delivery system of electricity and telephones are based on lines, right? And that's an ancient system, an old system that has not been capitalized since it was first built, mm-hmm. basically. And so it's very, very difficult under the current political climate then to invite independent investors to come in to invest in that infrastructure when you have a small opposition who's able to block political progress in the country so handily by virtue of their relationship to in Washington. One of the other bigger problems remains the tremendous power of the small, tiny, wealthy elite. These people wield tremendous power with the Republican administration. These people go to golf courses and go to restaurants and are friendly with members of this administration. And so they still feel they can get away without paying their taxes. They still feel they can get away with controlling monopolies of importing goods at the expense of local business in Haiti reap tremendous products and eliminate anyone who wants to go into competition with them and get away with it and continue to get away with it. And so far, that seems to be right in line with what the Republican administration has in mind for Haiti, which is business as usual. And yeah, you can have your little democratic experiment, but the truth is, when push comes to shove, we're still going to back that small wealthy elite against the majority of the poor, and we're going to try to keep things as much the same as they have been in Haiti, because we can control that, and anything new, we're not sure we can.
Well, Kevin Pina, I like to try to end interviews on an up note. So we have a little minute to do that. And I know that you started out talking about, you know, the spirit of the Haitian people. And so what next?
Well, I think that my Haitian friends would love to see as many people organize themselves to come to Haiti as possible January the 1st. It's an open invitation to the world. There will be a South African delegation. Nelson Mandela will be there. He's already agreed. There are many other world leaders who've agreed to come. Mikhail Gorbachev, I understand, has agreed to come. So this will be an international event to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the world's first black republic, the 200th anniversary of the world's only successful slave revolution, and a time to pay homage to the resistance, the resiliency, and the creativity and spirit of the Haitian people.
Okay, well, that sounds like a good plan to go visit Haiti, get to know Haiti, and know that this is only one place where all these things are happening that are so difficult, and really international solidarity and information is so important. So thank you for bringing us this news of Haiti, Kevin Pina. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, SUESUPRIANO.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.